Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Mark Pegram, and to begin, we chatted about clinical research in HER2-positive breast cancer, and I asked Dr. Pegram what his thoughts were about one of the most intriguing new trials in that subset, NSABP-B50, or the KATHERINE trial, comparing the antibody-drug conjugate trastuzumab emtansine versus trastuzumab in patients with residual disease at surgery after receiving preoperative systemic treatment.
We're certainly participating in the NSABP-B50 trial here at Stanford. That study is already open and accruing well. And that's a very interesting and innovative study design that looks at patients that fail to achieve a pathologic complete response after induction, trastuzumab, and chemo. And now they've allowed trastuzumab and pertuzumab and chemo patients to be eligible in that trial. So patients that don't get a path CR do have a higher relapse rate. That's well known from multiple studies in the literature. Consequently, it's a perfect study population. And so in B50, those patients are randomized to continue the 1 year of adjuvant trastuzumab, which they would get anyway as standard of care, versus finishing off the year with T-DM1 instead. So I think that's a very interesting and innovative and promising study design that will answer questions quickly in early breast cancer, a little bit unique patient population because it's only the ones that didn't have a path CR. But if that's a positive trial, then our enthusiasm for developing T-DM1 further in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting will be heightened. History tells us that the lessons learned from metastatic breast cancer are often magnified when one looks at earlier stage disease. Trastuzumab is an excellent case in point. Here's a drug which has modest single-agent activity in HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, especially in pretreated patients. It was quite modest. It's real, bang for the buck, even in metastatic disease, to this day remains in combination mostly with chemotherapeutics. And if you look at the pivotal trial in metastatic disease, there was a modest improvement in overall survival with the addition of trastuzumab, but the fraction of patients that had, real long control of disease was a minority. And so when you look at the joint analysis, however, in early stage breast cancer, those differences were huge. The trastuzumab arm had a 50% reduction in relapse events and a 1/3 improvement in mortality. So that was a much bigger efficacy signal than was ever observed in any of the metastatic trials, and suggests that kind of these microscopic subclinical adjuvant settings, these drugs may be more impactful in that situation. So I'm very optimistic about the prospects for the future of both T-DM1 and pertuzumab in early breast cancer. I think that there's no reason to think that they won't be at least as good as they've proven to be in metastatic disease, and maybe better.
So your former colleague, Dr. Dennis Slaman, presented the Beth trial
at
San Antonio, looking at bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting, adjuvant HER2 setting. Unfortunately, a negative trial. But one thing that he did present sort of at the end of the presentation, I wanted to get your take on, was he kind of like, I knew he wouldn't stand up there and just not say anything controversial.
Right.
So he kind of, it was interesting, at the end of the presentation, he looked at the control arm, basically the TCH patients in the trial, and tried to make an argument through indirect comparisons to some of the anthracycline trials, again, getting back to this issue of efficacy, anthracycline versus non-anthracycline. Any thoughts about what he presented and what he said and whether you agree with it or not?
Well, I mean, the most important aspect of the Beth trial was whether or not bevacizumab would add anything therapeutically, and it was very disappointing that it did not, really no even signal of efficacy. This was not entirely surprising to any of us, since the adjuvant work by our colleagues in the adjuvant colorectal cancer experience with the NSABP trial some years ago, presented by Norm Wallmark at ASCO and subsequently published. As soon as I saw that study, my enthusiasm for adjuvant bevacizumab in human solid tumors was diminished. Now, the one thing that's intriguing about HER2-positive metastatic disease is that I can tell you anecdotally, during phase 1 dose escalation with the trastuzumab plus bevacizumab studies we did at UCLA, and in phase 2 as well with that combination, we had quite impressive responses. This was a multi-site trial too. It was not just a single institution, single investigator study design. It was multiple investigators. So based on that, I was rather optimistic, at least in metastatic disease, that bevacizumab would add something substantive to the HER2-positive armamentarium. But then, of course, we had the results from the Avril trial, which, you know, showed trends in favor of bevacizumab randomization in that study, but these weren't important enough to be clinically relevant or significant. And sadly, even in metastatic disease, HER2 does not appear to be a niche population where bevacizumab may have important activity. And so it's been disappointing, but, you know, oncology is a tough disease, a tough problem, and that's why we have randomized trials. You do the preclinical work, the phase one, the phase two, you develop clinical hypotheses, and someday those have to be subject to hypothesis testing, and then you have to just move on once you get the results. A negative answer is important in this regard, and so I don't feel badly that at least we put this to a test, a big test in the case of the Beth trial, and it's negative, and that tells us something important about the biology of HER2-positive early breast cancer and says that we need to redirect our research focus somewhere else.
And what about the issue about the non-anthracycline data in that trial?
It's very problematic to make cross-trial comparisons, obviously, but it's, again, reassuring that for the patient population that was subject to the randomization of the Beth trial, the control arm appeared to do remarkably well with the TCH backbone in the adjuvant setting. So it further bolsters the notion that non-anthracycline regimens are safe and effective in HER2-positive early breast cancer. Whether the anthracyclines are superior or not, indeed, remains an open question. Unfortunately, in my view, the BCRG-006 trial did not actually answer that question satisfactorily. You know, when we talked to the biostatisticians in that trial, when they did a post-hoc analysis comparing the TCH to the ACTH arm, they said this trend is actually not statistically significant. I believe the p-value is like 0.2. 0.21, something like that. And so they, with a straight face, looked at us as the investigators and said, we can't be sure that this might not be just play of chance. So when I hear that from a biostatistician, as a clinical researcher, it's impactful to me. That said, there is a clear visual trend in the graphic analysis of that trial that seems to favor an anthracycline regimen. And for those who don't want to miss the opportunity, if that were to be real, to use an anthracycline-based regimen, I don't have a problem with that. In fact, for my patient population that I see in my own clinics in, let's say, lymph node positive, early HER2-positive breast cancer, the discussion of the day, without exception, is the merits and virtues of ACTH versus TCH, and I try to present them in a balanced and fair way and see if the patient has any concerns or wants to weigh in on these issues and let them make as an informed decision as they possibly can after seeing the data.
So let's talk about the cases you brought in here from the breast cancer tumor board that you put together. Maybe we can begin with the 42-year-old premenopausal lady.
So these are cases that are from the Stanford, you know, medical record archives that we had seen. Many of these cases are referred by community oncologists into our tumor board, so not all the patients receive their treatment at Stanford. I'll just give you that one caveat. Nevertheless, that said, the first patient I'd like to discuss is a 42-year-old premenopausal woman who was found to have a 3.5-centimeter spiculated mass in the left upper outer quadrant of the breast on routine mammographic imaging. A core biopsy showed an invasive ductal cancer. It was high grade. The steroid receptors were positive. The ER was about 40% nuclear staining, PR 80%. About 1 to 2 plus intensity of nuclear expression of the steroid receptors. It was HER2 negative by immunohistochemical staining, and the Ki-67 was 60%. Following the biopsy, she was treated surgically initially with a left modified radical mastectomy and axillary dissection, and the final pathology again showed a 3.6 centimeter high grade invasive ductal carcinoma. However, 8 of 19 lymph nodes in the axilla were positive. Postoperatively, she received adjuvant chemotherapy with dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel, and then she received post-mastectomy chest wall and regional nodal radiation. And so since this was a steroid receptor positive patient, premenopausal, we had to have a discussion about adjuvant endocrine therapies. And so, you know, the question comes up, 5 years of tamoxifen versus 10. And so we discussed with her the recent ATLAS and ATOM trials that showed superiority of 10 years of tamoxifen versus 5. And as a consequence, in a premenopausal patient, especially in her early 40s, this will probably be our preferred approach. However, I'll make note of the fact that the average age of menopause in the U.S. is about 51. This patient's had chemotherapy, so she may have an earlier menopause than average. It's possible. So we'll certainly consider the possibility of a switching strategy in this case as well. At year 5, if she's clearly menopausal, then we could, as long as we document that biochemically, serially indeed, we could consider switching to 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor based on previously published data from MA17 with 5 years of letrozole following 5 years of tamoxifen showing superiority to tamoxifen alone for 5 years.
So before you go on with the case, another thought related to that is this lady is multiple positive nodes, but I'm curious whether or not the nodal status or the risk status of the patient at diagnosis affects the way you look at what you do at 5 years. Initially, I was kind of hearing that that's the way people approached it, but now I'm kind of hearing some people say, well, when I use tamoxifen in a premenopausal woman as adjuvant therapy, the standard duration is 10 years. Which way do you go?
What I've been showing in my clinic, actually, is I've been showing patients after 5 years, I've been showing them the Kaplan-Meier plots, believe it or not. Stanford has a fairly sophisticated patient population, as you might imagine. And I show them the data from Atlas and from Adam. And some patients are very impressed by that analysis. And others look at it and say, well, look, there's only about a 3% absolute difference, and I'm having a lot of toxicities. I'm not interested. And so, again, this is a balanced discussion that I think is worth having with your patients. Certainly, people that have higher risk, it certainly stays on our radar even more intensely over time. But there are patients who are at risk with even node-negative breast cancer. And so there's probably nothing magic about number of nodes in terms of the biology and the rationale for prolonged systemic adjuvant endocrine therapy.
And I guess you can make the argument for chemo prevention also.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a very strong argument. Then last thing I'll mention about this case is, you know, the concept of an AI with ovarian suppression. And all of us, I think, are waiting on the sidelines for the upcoming text and soft trials to report. And if those are positive trials supporting a role for adjuvant AIs, even in premenopausal patients, that might one day become a new standard of care if those studies are positive. So until then, I think that remains an option, but not one that's data-driven until those large phase 3 trials report.
So it looked like this lady did not want to continue therapy beyond 5 years and then unfortunately developed disease relapse.
That's right. Not only did she not want to take tamoxifen beyond 5 years, but apparently she didn't like oncologists either because she was frankly lost to follow-up for a few years. And in 2013 came back with metastatic relapse, unfortunately, presenting with a left pleural effusion due to metastatic disease. This was confirmed by imaging studies and by cytologic analysis for pleural fluid, which showed, again, ERPR positive metastatic disease. And again, the HER2 status was negative, this time by FISH with a ratio of 0.81. A CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis also showed several bilateral pulmonary nodules that were suspicious, as well as mediastinal adenopathy. And a bone scan showed a right lateral rib lesion, which was concerning for metastatic disease. She had a pleurodesis procedure via video-assisted thoracoscopic approach, and that controlled her pleural effusion symptomatology. She, at this time, had become postmenopausal for the past 5 years, no menses, and her estradiol was clearly in the postmenopausal range. So she was a candidate for an aromatase inhibitor as first-line treatment for metastatic disease, in addition to a bone-acting agent. In this case, we chose denosumab based on the randomized phase 3 trial of denosumab compared to zoledronic acid showing superiority of denosumab in controlling skeletal-related events. So she was placed on anastrozole and denosumab. You know, we considered a number of other options, including chemotherapy, but fortunately she was not symptomatic enough and did not have a disease burden concerning that we needed to move directly into cytotoxic therapy, so those were lower down on our list. At the time that she was treated, our CDK4/6 inhibitor trial was not yet open at Stanford, so she was not screened for that study protocol. It's now open, and that would now be our preferred treatment for a patient like this who meets the eligibility criteria, first-line ER-positive metastatic disease. So that's a very exciting ongoing study based on randomized phase 2 data and indeed preclinical data done by Richard Finn at UCLA showing promising effects of CDK4/6 inhibition in ER-positive luminal breast cancers in combination with aromatase inhibition.
So I want to ask you about the CDK inhibitor, but just to sort of flesh out, though, the non-trial options, you mentioned anastrozole, which is what she got, but What about the possibility of combining anastrozole and fulvestrant? We've seen some data on that approach over the last couple of years. And I mean, I'll just put out there exemestane and everolimus, although this is not a typical situation where you'd use it, but maybe right. just to go through those two options.
Yeah, I mean, the anastrozole plus fulvestrant combination is not unreasonable in a case like this one. However, you know, that begs the question, could you get the same efficacy by simply using anastrozole followed by fulvestrant, for example? And I think for that reason, single agent treatment would be reasonable to consider. But I would have no strong objection to a combination of anastrozole plus fulvestrant in this setting either. As you rightly point out, the exemestane plus everolimus approach is for patients who have progressed following treatment with a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor like anastrozole in this case. So I think if she were to progress in the future and needed second-line endocrine therapy, I think that's where this combination would come to light.
So you mentioned the CDK4/6 inhibitor, and we saw some exciting data on that at the San Antonio meeting last year. Maybe you can comment on what it is, how it works, what we know about it, and this new study you're talking about.
So Richard Finn, who was actually a student who worked with me when I was at UCLA, worked in the lab, and is still on the faculty there at UCLA, having completed his fellowship in oncology there, he was studying a large panel of breast cancer cell lines and screening new inhibitors against this large panel in an empiric fashion, and got a hit with the CDK4/6 inhibitor that they were studying in the lab, and found in this large panel, the efficacy of this agent was the most potent in luminal ER-positive breast cancers, particularly those cell lines that had amplification of cyclin D, increased expression of RB, or loss of P16. So based on those observations, which were purely laboratory observations, there was a big effort that led eventually to this randomized phase 2 trial of patients with ER-positive metastatic disease who were randomized to aromatase inhibitor versus aromatase inhibitor plus the CDK4/6 inhibitor. And the trial results, even though it was a relatively small phase 2 trial, the results were nothing short of spectacular. The CDK4/6 inhibitor-treated patients had a much longer progression-free survival compared to the control arm, and the drug was well tolerated. Now, this is, you know, an inhibitor that is associated with cell cycle arrest based on its mechanism of action. That's not surprising. So it will hit rapidly proliferating cellular compartments. So there are cytopenias, for example, that are observed in terms of toxicities with CDK4/6 inhibition, but it doesn't have the same types of other systemic toxicities that chemotherapy would be expected to have. So it's overall better tolerated than a chemotherapeutic approach. So based on those phase 2 randomized data, a large randomized phase 3 trial with essentially the same study design as the randomized phase 2 trial, very large randomized phase 3 trials underway in ER-positive first-line metastatic breast cancer. They also have a study in combination with fulvestrant that's ongoing as well. So this is probably not going to be restricted to aromatase inhibition. Moreover, in the preclinical experiments I should mention, in Richard Finn's preclinical publication, he showed some synergism between tamoxifen and the CDK4/6 inhibitor as well.
What's your vision? When you're talking about HER2, it kind of seems like even though ER is, you know, so much older, it almost seems like we know less about it. What's your current vision about why people either don't respond to hormonal therapy or respond and then progress? You know, what the mechanisms are of escape, and maybe biologically why an agent like this might sort of synergize with hormone therapy if you think it does.
So, you know, whenever you think that everything's been done in oncology, that's when you can be sure that it probably hasn't been. It is kind of surprising sometimes when a question comes up in discussions with colleagues, collaborators, or at a scientific meeting, you think, oh, well, some important topic surely must have been studied, you know, back in the 70s or something. Well, in fact, a lot of times it hasn't been. So we continue to learn new material all the time, even against old targets. So even though the steroid receptors are old, look at the results from San Antonio this year. The fraction of patients with steroid receptor mutations in pretreated cases was, I believe, double-digit frequency. It was much higher than the previous published studies, which were probably de novo diagnosed primary tumors untreated that have a low frequency of ER mutations. But in pretreated patients, this may also be a resistance mechanism, at least based on its frequency. I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't pan out. That, I think, is going to become a very important avenue of investigation. The other important avenue of investigation are all the steroid receptor co-activators and co-repressors. You know, we still aren't exploiting that knowledge yet routinely in the clinic. And yet there are a number of hypotheses demonstrating how important these co-activators and co-repressors are in dictating steroid receptor action. And I think that's another avenue of investigation that's ripe to exploit clinically and needs a lot more work.
And again, any idea about why this particular agent, you mentioned that it was very empiric, but you know, maybe would synergize with hormonal therapy?
I don't have a clear explanation that I can offer you, to be honest. It was an empiric finding that the luminal ER-positive breast cancers were the most sensitive. Obviously, the cases that have high cyclin D, high RB, and low P16, that I can definitely predict because those are intimately involved in how CDK serine 3-amine kinases work. But why it should be mainly in this ER-positive subtype, I don't actually know. But it does open up a lot of possibilities that maybe these inhibitors could be used outside of the context of just steroid treatments too. It may work with other combinations that we use in breast cancer also, in my view. It should be tested at least.
Let's talk about your second patient, a 34-year-old woman.
So this was a 34-year-old patient who had left breast pain radiating to her wrist. She was referred to her primary doctor for an ultrasound that showed two small nodules, about 10 millimeters, 11 millimeters respectively, in the upper outer quadrant at the 12 and 2 o'clock positions. And the study was interpreted as a BI-RADS 3, probably benign, and a follow-up recommendation for imaging was done in 6 months' time. Whereupon, on follow-up, she was found to have enlargement of one of the two lesions, specifically the 12 o'clock nodule had enlarged. So at that time, a corneal biopsy was performed, which showed a high-grade DCIS, but also a component of grade 3 invasive ductal carcinoma, which was ER, PR negative, and HER2 positive 3+ by IHC with a Ki-67 of 90%. So she was referred to a breast surgeon for further evaluation, and there was some visible fullness in the superior left breast on examination, and on palpation there was a palpable mass that measured 53 by 37 millimeters in that same span of 11 to 2 o'clock position. There was also a palpable 1 centimeter firm left axillary node, which was suspicious. There was no supraclavicular or infraclavicular adenopathy, and the contralateral breast exam was normal. She underwent diagnostic mammography and an MRI of both breasts, and that showed an extensive abnormal enhancement of the entire upper left breast, measuring 7 by 5.1 by 4 centimeters. And there was clumped enhancement at the 6 o'clock position also that may represent DCIS. And there was also felt to be likely metastatic involvement of the left axillary lymph nodes based on these imaging studies as well. So the question was, you know, where to go from here in terms of the diagnostic workup. And so it was decided that she should have a left axillary ultrasound and needle biopsy to see whether we could confirm the presence of metastasis in the suspicious left axillary nodes. And because of the size of her primary tumor as well as the clinical nodal involvement, we recommended systemic staging studies as well. So she had a PET CT, and this showed diffuse FDG uptake in the left breast, a highly suspicious uptake in the left axilla, and also the internal mammary nodes were also positive on that exam. And there were some nonspecific pulmonary nodules in the right, middle, and lower lobes, which were of undetermined significance. An ultrasound-guided FNA of a palpable left axillary lymph node, however, showed only reactive nodal tissue and no carcinoma was identified on the FNA. So we couldn't confirm that pretreatment based on just the FNA approach. As you know, that's associated with some degree of false negative results, and it was felt that that was the most likely explanation for the negative needle biopsy because she really did have palpable suspicious nodes, and the imaging studies were particularly impressive in the axilla. So the question then was, okay, what about neoadjuvant therapy for a locally advanced HER2-positive breast cancer? And so this begs the question about whether or not to incorporate pertuzumab into our current treatment paradigms based on the recent accelerated approval granted by the FDA for pertuzumab as neoadjuvant treatment for HER2-positive breast cancer in combination with chemo and trastuzumab. And so that's what this patient received. She received a neoadjuvant regimen incorporating trastuzumab and pertuzumab based on this FDA guidance and accelerated approval pathway, which was based purely on PCR rates from the NeoSphere trial that have been previously published, in addition to some safety studies from the TRIFINA study that looked at cardiac safety of pertuzumab-containing regimens in early-stage HER2-positive breast cancer.
I want to dissect out a little bit more in terms of the choice of therapy and also specifically the choice of chemotherapy. But first, any comments about the FDA action? Do you agree with it?
I think it's an exciting opportunity, and I applaud the FDA for coming up with new guidances like this, which are perhaps paradigm shifting. It's the first drug approved for neoadjuvant breast cancer, so a remarkable turn of events. This FDA guidance does demand, in addition to superiority in terms of efficacy for the PathCR endpoint, they also demand a commitment to future time-to-event phase 3 trials, either in the neoadjuvant setting or in the adjuvant setting. So in this case, the adjuvant affinity trial, which will test chemotrastuzumab versus chemotrastuzumab plus pertuzumab head-to-head in a large phase 3 adjuvant study, that's the type of study they want to see commitment to in order to use this accelerated approval mechanism. So I applaud the effort. I think it's very interesting. It's innovative. It gets the drug to our patients who need, you know, improvements in efficacy, arguably. Pertuzumab adds very little in terms of toxicity. In the safety studies, there was somewhat increase in incidence of diarrhea when pertuzumab was added, and also in cutaneous rash, but fortunately no effect on the left ventricular ejection fractions in the cardiac safety study. And in terms of tolerability, we know from a vast safety experience in the phase 3 stage 4 metastatic breast cancer trials, we know very well the safety profile of this agent, and it's quite well tolerated. The only thing that is concerning with this accelerated pathway is, you know, whether or not these PathCR results will hold up in the long term without further adjuvant pertuzumab. You know, the approval is only for neoadjuvant pertuzumab, not adjuvant. And I don't know whether, in the absence of continued pressure in the adjuvant setting, whether these PathCR results will in fact translate into long-term benefits. We simply don't have that answer yet, and perhaps won't until we get the affinity trial results in. So that's probably my only caveat. I will tell you that NCCN took a little bit different position than FDA did on this as well. They have a line in their guidelines, which is quite provocative, but does acknowledge the fact that there's probably no difference in biology from, let's say, a stage 2 HER2-positive breast cancer that's seen by a surgeon first and has a lumpectomy and axillary surgery versus someone who goes to a medical oncologist first and gets neoadjuvant HER2-targeted therapy with chemo first. So in the NCCN guidelines, it states that fact, that that biology is probably no different in terms of micrometastasis. So the NCCN guideline goes one step further and says that pertuzumab could be considered in the adjuvant setting if people are already post-op at the time of clinical presentation to the oncologist. But they don't specify how long one should treat patients in that setting. And so if I were to do that, I probably wouldn't go farther than the 4 to 6 cycles that were supported in the FDA label based on NeoAlto.
Yeah, I'm curious to see whether anybody's getting that paid for.
Yeah, I think that would be a huge challenge. And I would expect that payers may be reluctant to do 1 year of pertuzumab until after the efficacy results from Affinity are available. I'm sure that's probably quite right.
I think the other thing, though, is that, you know, even though a lot of times it doesn't really make that much difference, if any, in the type of surgery, there are situations where patients want to have breast conservation, and having a little bit better PathCR objective response rate helps.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in that case, one's enthusiasm, if you have a patient that might be on the fence for breast conservation versus mastectomy, then this could be very impactful, because having a high clinical response and PathCR rate both would be important in dictating type of surgery selected for the operation. That's a good point.
Kind of seems like since that FDA approval, and I've been talking to both docs in practice and investigators, that people are just using pertuzumab when they're going to use neoadjuvant therapy for HER2-positive disease. Technically, it's supposed to be more than 2 centimeters, I guess. But other than that, I hear people saying they're just using pertuzumab. Is that what you're doing?
We are. I've done that ever since the FDA approval. off study. I've been treating all of my HER2 positive patients with early breast cancer in the neoadjuvant setting. In fact, we've gone so far as to kind of prefer a neoadjuvant treatment strategy with our surgeons. They're very collaborative with us here at my institution. And so we've been automatically, at the time of our tumor board, shuttling those patients to a neoadjuvant strategy deliberately, if they're candidates for systemic adjuvant therapy in the first place, obviously. But that's now a preferred treatment for us locally. I agree.
Now, another thing I have heard some discussion about or lack of clarity about is exactly how to use this in the neoadjuvant setting, which chemo regimen and exactly what you do. It seems like there are a number of options. What are the options that you feel are, you know, sort of evidence-based, and what do you tend to do?
So this is an interesting point also, where there's a little bit of a lack of harmonization between the FDA label indication versus the NCCN guideline language. The FDA label approved neoadjuvant pertuzumab-containing regimen specifically with docetaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab based on the NeoSphere study, followed by adjuvant FEC, I might add. They also mentioned the label that neoadjuvant FEC followed by neoadjuvant docetaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab based on the TRIFINA study may be an option to consider. And the label also indicates that TCH for 6 cycles with 6 cycles of pertuzumab would also be a possibility based on the TRIFINA study. The FDA label specifically states that there's no safety data with doxorubicin-containing regimens. The safety and efficacy of pertuzumab for greater than 6 cycles in early breast cancer has not been established. We can all agree on that. But they were reluctant to extend their label language. They were reluctant to extend it to anthracycline-based regimens, ironically. So the NCCN took a different tack. They said that preferred neoadjuvant HER2-positive regimens would include AC followed by paclitaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab. And also they suggested that TCH would also be a reasonable treatment option, so they agreed with the FDA on that particular regimen. So the NCCN was somewhat more liberal on their interpretation of the NeoSphere trial results and suggested that there was sufficient safety data from other data sets looking at sequences of anthracyclines followed by HER2 targeting agents with taxanes, that that would be acceptable in their guidelines.